Good morning. I'd like to call the Senate Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 11, 2018. The time is 9:45 a.m. I apologize for the delay. There are other meetings that are happening in the building that several members from Finance Committee attended this morning. I'd like to welcome at the table Co-Chairman Hoffman.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff. Senator Stevens.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning to all. We should be joined shortly by Senator Machicki, who is on other state business. On today's agenda, we have HB 128, Shellfish Enhancement Projects, Hatcheries, and HB 121, Occupational Health and Safety Civil Penalties. Is there anything to come before the committee before we begin? Seeing and hearing none, I'd like to direct committee members' attention to House Bill 128. A brief history on the bill. On April 3rd, we had a presentation and introduction, a sectional analysis, and the public hearing was opened and closed. We have not covered the fiscal notes. I'd like to invite Representative Dan Ortiz and Mary Hakala, a staff to Representative Ortiz, to the microphone. Sir, my staff usually gives me a phonetical spelling of names so that we can get everything correct on the record. So please guide us today first with an introduction of who you are, where you represent, and then a brief overview on HB 128. Welcome, Senator Machicki.
And good morning, Madam Chair and members of this esteemed committee. My name is Dan Ortiz, and I represent Southern Southeast Alaska, District 36. And to my right, Mary.
Mary Hakala, staff to Rep. Ortiz, or Ortiz.
Ortiz.
Good morning again, members of the committee. Thank you again for taking your busy schedules time to hear HB 128. Just as a review, HB 128 deals with shellfish enhancement projects. It sets up the regulatory framework for the mariculture industry. It's a priority for the Mariculture Task Force that has worked hard over the last 2 years to present a cohesive, well-considered plan to move mariculture forward in the state. HB 128 is an important component of that plan, and we're excited about the economic opportunities it presents. I again would like to take the opportunity to thank Senator Stevens for being a co-sponsor of this particular bill and for carrying mirror legislation on the Senate side. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll open myself up and Mary to questions of the committee.
Are there questions from committee members? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Ortiz, as we look at the bill and see the increase by tenfold of the application fee, what's the thinking behind it? It sounds like you're going to try and screen out some of the smaller operators that are going to try and do something on their own that maybe don't have the reserves that other people have. And the only familiarity I have is the Kachemak Bay mariculture operations that are down there.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I will ask that Mary Hockley answer that question as well. But I can say that that particular increase in the fee, that fee has not been changed for a number of years, and we certainly have not heard any concern from the supporters of this bill, which come from that very industry, from where these applications would come from. We haven't heard any concern about that increase fee amount, and again, it hasn't been changed in a number of years. So with that said, I don't see it having any damping effect on interest in accessing those funds.
There's no complaint, Madam Chair, if I'm finished with my questions.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Any other questions from committee members? Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So Representative Ortiz, it says authorizing certain nonprofit organizations to engage in shellfish enhancement projects. So if there does this bill address anything for-profit organizations, or is this just not-for-profit?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, in this particular industry, we're talking about enhancement organizations like SARA, NSERA, those types of organizations, which historically in this industry have been nonprofit organizations. We're certainly not opposed to profit-based organizations being a part of the industry, but just the format and the history of how this particular, you know, the seafood industry in general, with processors obviously are part of the profit industry, and that's a good thing. But when you're talking about enhancement of anything, whether it's salmon or shellfish seed, those kinds of things, it's not necessarily related to profit-based operations.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow-up.
Thank you. That's pretty much the heart of my question is, how do the nonprofits and the profit centers, organizations, interact through the cycle of a biological species? And so you have the nonprofits, I think. Well, I'm going to let you describe it. So how do those two interact?
You want to hear?
Through the chair, what I'd suggest is that we call the Alaska Department of Fish and Game up. I think they are going to be better able to answer that in a comprehensive way. And I just did want to point out this bill is clearly nonprofit corporations only, and that's page 2, line 18. And it mirrors the salmon enhancement statutes that are exclusively nonprofit entities.
Ms. Hakala, thank you for that response. If I could, thank you, Representative Ortiz, for presenting today. Thank you, Ms. Hakala. We do have some questions from Fish and Game. So beyond that, Representative, I'm going to be asking questions on the recovery, the cost recovery fishery that is inside the bill. I don't know if you need your staff there yet. We can move to Fish and Game right now so that you can think about that. So if I could excuse you from the microphone while we discuss a few things with Fish and Game on invasive species. But I'd like you to contemplate an answer regarding crabs. So there are different types of creatures. I won't have the appropriate names for them, but they reproduce differently, and they are different than the salmon enhancement. Salmon are coming back and migrating to a specific location, and we are bringing in boats and other commercial activities to recover the fish that show up for reasons that you have told us, to reduce pollution, to enhance recovery based on the capturing of the eggs and being able to put those out in a market. And that helps with the cost recovery of the salmon enhancement program. You are using cost recovery in this bill for a group of species that do not return or migrate to a particular destination all the time. Seaweed, gooey ducks, oysters, and crabs come to mind as at least mentioned species. And I know the crabs, unless you're containing them and holding them in a particular area, are going to move out and are of benefit, but I'm just think about the answer in regards to cost recovery on that particular, and I'll bring you back to the microphone to talk to us.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. For the committee's edification, we do have Sam Kumba here from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. We have Jenny Eckert, a professor from the University of Fairbanks College of Fisheries and Ocean Science, available to you today in the room, I believe, as well as online. We have Julie Decker, who is the chair of the Alaska Mariculture Task Force, and Heather McCarty, co-chair of the Alaska King Crab Research, Rehabilitation, and Biological, and that's called ACCRAB, available for a resource for your discussion today. If you could identify yourself for the record, and Senator Von Imhoff, after that's done, if you could pose your question.
Good morning, Madam Chair. Thank you. My name is Sam Raybung. I'm with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I'm the statewide aquaculture planning and permitting section chief.
Mr. Raybaugh, I do want to let the committee know we also have Brad Mays from the Department of Law, the Natural Resource Section, online. Forrest Bauer from the Department of Fish and Game here in Chuno available for questions. I believe that's our resources today. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. One of the philosophical questions that I ask myself is, when is it appropriate for the state to insert itself into a, let's say, a business cycle or a commercially viable profit cycle? In particular cases such as what we're looking at here with shellfish enhancement, there arguably is a point in the cycle where it's not commercially viable and there needs to be perhaps a kickstart of some nonprofit entity, state grants, what have you. I would like to learn more about why it's no commercial entity would insert itself in this niche that the state seeks to fill.
Through the chair. That's a really good question. Thank you for asking that. So this bill is modeled after the Salmon Fishery Enhancement Bill that's been in law since 1974. And it's based, this model was developed because the fisheries resources of the state are common property. They're owned by all the people of the state. And by letting enhancement programs be for profit, it kind of provides an ownership aspect of it. So instead, the program is modeled after it's more of a user industry, a service industry. And that's just on the production end of it, producing the juveniles. The for-profit aspect comes in during harvest. So anything produced by these programs are available for harvest for all of the common property fisheries of the state, and they are all for-profit. And so that's the model that's been used. And to be clear that they are nonprofit corporations, but they still have to, pay their taxes and make ends meet. They have budgets, and they operate similarly to a for-profit organization, with the exception of being able to pay dividends and things like that.
Senator Von Imhoff, follow-up?
No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And these nonprofits, they employ an Alaskan workforce. Right, provide jobs?
Through the chair, that's correct. They employ the salmon industry, salmon fishery enhancement. We don't call it salmon enhancement because we're not enhancing the salmon. We're enhancing the salmon fishery. And they employ hundreds of people.
Senator Michicki.
Actually, can you just, what this does, it sets a regulatory framework for some species that are either challenged in production, like king crab, or are newer technologies or newer commercially feasible fisheries, such as sea cucumber, gooey duck, abalone, and razor clams, right? So can you just tell us what the bill does? I think that's the part that's missing on helping the committee understand. We're focused on the relationship with for-profit versus non-profit. Just tell us what the bill does. I think that would be helpful.
Through the chair. So this bill enables several different models of fishery enhancement. It's going to benefit the dive fisheries and pot fisheries, because that's the types of fisheries that would harvest these shellfish species. And one model is if a species is depressed or below a harvestable surface for a considerable period of time, and king crab comes to mind. There hasn't been commercial king crab fisheries around the Kodiak area since the 80s, for example. It's been closed. We've used management and research for 30-plus years, and they still haven't come back. So we don't have any other tools. So this is a tool where you could, and I'm going to use the king crab example here, and then I'll follow up with from different species examples. You could collect gravid females, pregnant females, from the area that you want to increase production from. You bring them into your hatchery facility, and you protect them. When they release the larva, they're free swimming, and that's when the vast majority of them perish in the wild. Well, you can protect them in your facility from predation. They're basically eaten as larva. And so you increase the number significantly until they settle out and become a juvenile crab, and then you can put them back to where their parents came from. And so the idea is that you increase the biomass over a number of years until they reach a point where they've overcome the pressures that have kept their population from growing, and they can reproduce naturally and be self-sustaining. That's what we call a rehabilitation or a restoration project. Another model that would be enabled by this is specifically fishery enhancement. So a dive fishery such as sea cucumbers that you mentioned, or abalone, or geoduck is another one, urchins. A dive fishery comes in and harvests the wild stock, the standing crop in an area. And then it takes a while for natural recruitment to replenish that stock to a level where it could be harvested again. And so they have to leave an area fallow for a number of years until it comes back. So the model that could be used if this bill is passed is they could collect adults from that area right before they do a fishery to harvest them. They would retain those adults in the hatchery, allow them to spawn, protect the juveniles until they're of a size where they could be back planted back where the parents came from. And so you would speed up that replenishment cycle. So that's a fishery enhancement model. I heard kelp mentioned earlier. Kelp is not part of this bill. Seaweed's not part of this bill.
Senator Manchiki.
So the reason for the bill is they're not allowed to do that today with most of those species, and this will allow you to regulate it so those fisheries can be replenished for hopefully a more sustainable harvest. Is that correct?
Through the chair, that is correct. The only species that's allowable under state law to do fishery enhancement work on is salmon.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Are there further questions, Senator Stevens?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to ask Sam if he'd comment on, we're not the first ones, the first state to think along the lines of rehabilitation and enhancement. Can you give us a brief idea of what's going on in the rest of the world and the rest of the country? It is being done now in other places, right?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. It is being done in other places in the world, but not like we do it in Alaska. And I'll use our salmon program as a model. We have very high sideboards on our salmon fishery enhancement program that nobody else in the world has. We're restricted to using local stocks, genetically appropriate stocks for each project. We're restricted to no breeding. They have to remain wild, random matings, things like that. Large number of broodstocks to prevent genetic bottlenecking, very stringent health policies, So to date, there's no empirical evidence of any harm to natural production of salmon from our salmon fishery enhancement program. And we've been able to maintain sustainability certifications along with our hatchery production in places like Prince William Sound, where sometimes up to 80% of the harvest comes from hatchery production. And that's because we have a wild stock priority. And we will maintain all of those standards with this bill. In fact, this bill is modeled as closely to the Salmon Fishery Enhancement Bill as possible because it works.
Thanks, Sam.
Are there questions on any other fish and game aspects, invasive species? I believe, Sam, that you've already responded to that, but if you have any feedback to provide the audience at home, committee members around invasive species entering into Alaska waters. I think you just spoke to it a bit. Senator Machicki.
And I just, if you can help us, just like in the finfish program, Sam, can you just talk about monitoring of the health? So they're low. It's local brood stock, if you will. It can only be released to its original environment, but can you talk about the monitoring for disease? I think that's something that people don't recognize that happens in the raising process prior to release.
Through the chair, yeah, that's a great question. We have a very stringent fish health policy, which is not just in our view, fish is all aquatic organisms. We lump them all together and we call it a fish health policy. And it specifically deals with practices and disease prevention and monitoring for all of our species, and they have to be inspected and approved before release. So we have a pathology lab here in Juneau. We have another one in Anchorage, and all of our samples are processed through those. So we intend to continue to safeguard our natural production, both fish health-wise or pathology-wise, as well as genetically by applying those same stringent principles to any species that we would do, that we would produce and release back into the wild. Our premise is first do no harm, ensure that they are appropriate before they're released, and the entire purpose for putting them in the water is for harvest. That's the goal. The fish, the organisms that are produced and put in the water are intended for harvest. It's intended to supplement and support commercial fisheries, which is an economic engine for the coastal areas of the state of Alaska. One other question I didn't address earlier, if you would indulge me, is regarding the cost recovery. These projects have to be paid for. They're user pay. So there are several models that could be used to pay for them. And these are exactly the same as the Salmon Fishery Enhancement Program. And you were right to point out that the species are different and they behave differently. So we will have to adjust that cost recovery model slightly just to fit the species. So if it's a direct cost recovery by the permit holder, the project permit holder, we will establish a location where they've enhanced the population there and there is additional fish or crab or whatever it is, that they will be allowed to harvest a portion of that to recover some of their costs for producing them. Another model that's built in this is called an assessment, a fishery assessment, and that is when you allow the common property fishery to fish in that same area, and a percentage of their of the value that they would derive from that would be peeled off at the processor and provided back to pay for the project. The third item is we're modeling after the salmon enhancement tax. We haven't gone down that road yet. That'll be a different bill, I understand, if we go down that road. But that's where the fishery users themselves vote in a self-assessment tax to fund this activity.
Sam, thank you for testifying before Senate Finance today. I'd like to welcome, we've been joined by the Academy Charter School from Palmer, that are in our audience today, and so I'm going to divert a bit backwards so that they understand where Senate Finance is at. We are reviewing House Bill number 128. It is an act relating to the management of enhanced stock of shellfish authorizing certain nonprofit organizations to engage in shellfish enhancement projects relating to the application fee for salmon hatchery permits and providing for an effective date. The committee is currently under discussion, and we just had Fish and Game at our microphone, who exited the microphone before we may have been complete. That's all right, Sam. You can sit there for a little bit. I think he was taking your introduction as an exit strategy. With that, I do want to put a few more things on the record after the committee welcomes you. So thank you for caring about your government and participating in today's meeting by watching and listening. We do have Jenny Ekberg online. Here, Jenny, if you could approach the microphone, and if you need to have Sam respond, that would be fine to invite him back to the microphone, too. Regarding the range of species that fall under the shellfish definition, can you provide the committee with not necessarily an inclusive list, but how the species are arrived at, and what species we're talking about providing an opportunity for an enhancement project?
So for the record, my name is Jenny Eckert. I'm a professor in the fisheries program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. To answer the question, so this bill applies to shellfish. And to clarify, and the definition is defined in the bill as a species of crustacean mollusk or other invertebrate in any stage of its life cycle that's indigenous to state waters. So this excludes any invasive species. And for examples, we've talked already about king crab as being one example. So any species of crab would fall into this. Any species of clam, so we've talked about gooey duck clams. We could talk about razor clams. We could talk about abalone. Here's another really valuable species whose population has truly plummeted. There definitely is interest to do enhancement with this species. So sea cucumbers or others that we've talked about. Many of these invertebrate fisheries are incredibly lucrative in the state, and so there's interest in order to facilitate their recovery or enhance the fisheries.
Thank you for those comments, Jenny. Mr. Rungbach, could you talk about those species and how you will, as Fish and Game, prioritize or direct folks that are applying for applications towards a species that may be, as you said earlier, closed to harvesting in Alaska's waters. I think that the students weren't here when we had the discussion about the fisheries are a common held property of the entire state. They're a common interest for all of our people. Could you speak to that and then the how the department will go about approval and regulating any enhancements that might come forward?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is designed to be a user-driven project, so the department is not going to do anything until somebody applies for something. And so at that point, we will weigh in with guidance as far as what's the appropriate brood stock, the number, the location, treatments such as that. That'll all be part of the review process and will be spelled out in a permit, just as it is with salmon now. So again, unless somebody applies for it, we're not going to direct anything. It'll be at that point that we'll weigh in and put the sideboards on a permit that would allow and not allow to guide their actions.
Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Nijicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Eckert, could you just expound on what you do at UAF to help? Do you interface with fishing game? Do you, the industry, do you help promote the industry? I'm trying to give you if you could give me a thumbnail sketch, I'm letting you wave the flag for UAF.
Well, so I work for the university as a faculty member. So faculty teach classes, we do research, and then we do service. And so in that capacity, I've done a fair amount of research on king crab, and we've been studying king crab early life history to figure out could it be rehabilitated. So I'm sort of the scientist that's been doing the science behind the scenes. You know, we're interested in lots of questions related to fisheries. A lot of the work we do is related to fisheries to help improve the fisheries, make them more sustainable, address problems that may exist. So my role is to sort of answer the questions that are asked by the industry. I don't work for the industry. You know, our work is funded largely by governmental grants.
Thank you.
If I could follow up on that point, we do have a predator problem on some of our shellfish, specifically in the southeast area, and we are trying to get national attention regarding the decimation of some of the shellfish in our state, specifically abalone, clams, other shellfish in our area. The otters are creating a status for them that is unsustainable. Can you speak to that at all as far as the enhancement in the bill before us?
So I've also done research on sea otters and their diets, and I'm currently doing a whole variety of research looking at impacts on subsistence fisheries and then also looking at sort of the complex ecological interactions. So I work on many different aspects of this. With regard to the question of, you know, could I guess we would have to really think, and Fish and Game would definitely have a role in this, and thinking about, you know, where does it make the most sense to do enhancement? Certainly if there's a predator out there, you don't want to just grow things up and feed your predator. So you'd have to think about, you know, how to manage that. Now, you know, sea otters are not everywhere in Southeast Alaska, and there are, I mean, as a scientist, I would say, okay, well, let's think about where can we be smart about this. Let's do this in places where we think it's going to have the most impact, is where it's going to be most successful.
Mr. Robon, can you comment on how Fish and Game will handle applications? We're just going to let folks, will a geographic location be any part of the review process for this particular application, should it be successful? Should the bill be successful?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, absolutely. Every one of these projects will be assessed locally. I mean, they're not intended to spread very far and wide. They're intended to enhance localized fisheries. So they are going to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis as to appropriateness in a given location. And there's a public component to the permitting process as well that's detailed in here. So we're not going to force anything down anybody's throat, so to speak. There has to be public support for this because it's designed to benefit the public. I don't know if that answers or not.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
So I think what's missing is, so I'm a for-profit group. I come to the department. My name of my co-op is Peter's Gooey Ducks, okay? And I apply for a permit. You're going to be reviewing, before you approve, there's public comment, you're going to be reviewing the broodstock harvest, the hatchery plan, monitoring and release, prior to anything going forward, any approval. A part of that will be the nonprofit cost recovery so that eventually a for-profit harvest can occur. But in that area that has been enhanced, it also has public opportunities as well. It's not anyone cornering the market. It's a group that comes to you. Do I have it right? I think that's what's missing. Is it's it sounds mysterious if we don't think about how that process works. But could you help us with that a little bit?
Through the chair. Yes, it's a there's no ownership of the resource until it's harvested. So regardless of who produces the juveniles and puts them out there, they don't own them. They're not owned until they're harvested by the common property fishery. Anybody who's legal to fish in that fishery has access to them. So that's why I mentioned earlier it's a service industry, that the enhancement portion is a service industry. The whole intention is to benefit the common property fisheries of the state. The legislature ensured that by making it private nonprofit when they passed the Salmon Fishery Enhancement Bill in 1974, and that's worked well. We limit that aspect of it to being user-driven, stakeholder-driven is the term we use a lot, and self-funded, so that it's not corporate production. And that contrasts with farming. So we do have aquatic farming in the state of Alaska, and a lot of people get confused because this bill and aquatic farming utilize the same species. The difference is, with aquatic farming, it is owned by a private business from start to finish. There's no common property access to it. If the common property fishery, for example, dove on a gooey duck farm and harvested those, that's essentially theft, right? So in contrast, this is producing fish for specifically for the common property to harvest. There's no ownership of it until they are harvested. I don't know if that makes it clear enough. Aquatic farming requires positive control. They can't be released. They own the product from start to finish. And this one is common property ownership from start to finish.
Other questions from committee members? Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, I served on Cookland Inlet Aquaculture Board for years, and the reason I brought up the monitoring to ensure that diseased critters are not released into the public is it's heartbreaking when there is a batch that is, and they take no chances, and while I was there, had to destroy some batches, and it's heartbreaking because sometimes it just seems like such a minor little defect that could sort of solve itself with time, and I was always impressed that they have a no-risk policy as far as destroying that batch. So I'm comfortable with this program, this bill. Thank you.
Other questions from committee members? Thank you, Ms. Runbung, Mr. Runbung, and Ms. Eckert. Senator Bishop, are you prepared to cover the fiscal note?
Yes, ma'am.
Senator Bishop.
First fiscal note is 2171, Department of Fish and Game, Commercial Fisheries, Statewide Fisheries Management. The cost is zero. The Division of Commercial Fisheries intends to utilize existing staff under the aquaculture section to administer the program and the proposed legislation. We talked about the increase from $100 to $1,000 for an application. We talked about there probably would be three applications over as many years, and then it would probably go down to one permit application a year after that going forward. The second fiscal note is 4471, Department of Fish and Game, again, Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, zero, again, CFEC does not anticipate any additional cost. Third one is Department of Revenue, Taxation and Treasury, Allocation Tax Division, OMB component numbers 2476, zero analysis. The division estimates it will result in minimal revenues collected and deposited in the general fund. So the department will make any necessary changes in conjunction with with the passage of this bill. The bill will require a reg package to be promulgated, and that is about it on the analysis, Madam Chair. So 000 to sum up.
So we have three fiscal notes that we just reviewed. Are there questions on the fiscal note? Are we ready to move the bill? Senator Bishop.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 128, version 30-LS0449/David from committee with the accompanying fiscal notes and committee recommendations.
Are there objections? Seeing and hearing none, an act relating to management of enhanced stock fisheries, House Bill 128, version D, moves from committee with attached fiscal note and individual committee recommendations. Brief at ease while we sign the paperwork. Good morning. We're back on the record. Senate Finance, Wednesday, April 11, 2018. The next bill before us for introduction is House Bill 121, an act relating to occupational safety and health enforcement penalties and providing for an effective date. I'd like to invite Representative Sam Keto as well as Caitlin Ellis, staff to Representative Keto, to the microphone to introduce the bill. We also have Deborah Kelly, the director from the Division of Occupational Safety and Health. We can bring her up. We are bringing her up. Thank you. Ms. Kelly, Representative Keto, welcome to Senate Finance. Representative Keto, if you would state your name for the record and then please present an overview of House Bill 121.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of Senate Finance. And for the record, my name is Sam Keto III. I'm the representative from House District 33, downtown Juneau, northern southeast Alaska. And I am also the chair of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. In that role, the bill you have before you, House Bill 121, was introduced at the request of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. This bill actually brings the Alaska Occupational Safety and Health State Plan into compliance with federal requirements. This will ensure continued protection of workers from workplace injuries, illnesses, and fatalities. Alaska's failure to comply with this requirement from federal OSHA would jeopardize or could jeopardize $2 million in federal grants that we receive each year and could also result in our Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Program reverting to the federal government. With me today is Deborah Kelly with the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and she has additional detail about the bill, and we are both available to answer questions. With that, I will turn it over to Ms. Kelly.
Ms. Kelly, your name for the record, and then please proceed with your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Deborah Kelly. I'm Director of Labor Standards and Safety for the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. In 2015, Congress passed an Inflation Adjustment Act requiring many agencies to adjust their penalties for inflation, and in 2016, OSHA followed suit and adjusted their maximum penalties and required state plans to do the same. Alaska was required to follow suit by January 1st, 2017. And House Bill 121 brings the state into compliance by requiring the department to set the maximum OSHA penalties by regulation and caps those maximum penalties at the corresponding federal levels. This bill basically allows the state to come in compliance with federal requirements, no more and no less, and to stay in compliance with the yearly required adjustments by the CPI.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I do see in the packet here an OSHA fact sheet, and you've listed out three types of violations, the current maximum penalty and then the new maximum penalty. Is this Alaska? Is this Alaska data? And so is this and are these the only three that this bill addresses, or are there more?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that fact sheet is from a year ago, so that number is slightly adjusted, you'll see in the fiscal note. But there are several other categories of maximum penalties. I believe each bill section is a different category. So broadly, the categories are willful and repeat violations, serious violations, other than serious violations, failure to correct a violation, and posting requirement violations.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I think what might be helpful then is if there's any way to get a one-page table that just shows what they are now, all the different categories and what Alaska statute, the actual fee penalty, and then what the federal amounts are, and then how far out of compliance that we are, so we can just sort of see a comparison. And then I have a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay. On the other handout, you have, to Honorable Matt Klayman, and it has question number two. How much would the state save if Alaska's occupational safety and health jurisdiction were returned to federal OSHA? It says that it would result in a cost savings of $619 in state funds. Is that $619 per person or per instance, or is it $619,000? What am I reading here?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the $619 is $619,000 yearly that we, through our very basic calculation, found that the state would lose in state funds if we simply reverted the enforcement program to federal OSHA.
Okay. The sentence says this would result in a cost savings of $619,000 in state funds, following by, however, penalty revenue would go to the federal treasury instead of the state general fund, totaling of $1,031,000. This result in a net loss to the state of $412,000. When you say net loss to the state, does that mean that the state is not paying as high of penalties, or net loss to the state as in the state now has to pay more, is getting less revenue? I guess I didn't understand what that meant.
Through the chair. Senator Von Imhoff, I apologize. I misstated earlier. The cost savings would be in the reduction of our personal services, our local enforcement staff, and associated costs. However, the penalties coming in would now go to the federal treasury instead of the state treasury. So we're really talking about state general funds, not cost in individual or private business.
Senator Von Imhoff.
This is in the scenario if we do not comply. Is that correct? Number two is addressing if we do not comply with federal OSHA standards, this is what could happen. Is that what you're saying?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, broadly, yes. Obviously, if that were actually to occur, we'd go through a lot more planning stages and have to make a lot of decisions, and the numbers may come out differently in the end, but this is our analysis of what that would look like if we did not come into compliance.
Senator Michicki.
Well, if we did not go into compliance, or if we chose to allow jurisdiction to return to the feds, you can make that decision without being out of compliance. Isn't that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, the decision to have a state plan is always up to the state, so that could be reverted regardless of compliance, yes.
One more question.
Senator Michicki.
Is the $1,031,000 a constant? I mean, the way this is answered by the commissioner, how much is that vary annually? Is that an average over 10 years? Where did that number come from?
Ms. Kelly.
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, I would have to look at last year's fiscal note. I believe we used a three-year average last year, since we do have an updated fiscal note. But basically, we calculated this $1,031,000 based on our actuals for, again, I'd have to look at last year's fiscal note, I believe 3 years. And they do vary quite a bit from year to year because one significant case can add or subtract $100,000 to our penalty amount for the year. Roughly, we see about $500,000 or less than $500,000 a year in penalties today. Or I believe it was about $600,000 in the current fiscal note. Last year's to see where that number came from.
Brief at ease. We're back on the record. Ms. Kelly.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, the numbers in that letter that you referred to were from the fiscal note from last year, and that number used the fiscal year 2016 actual penalties collected. This year's fiscal note, we use a two-year average of this previous year and then FY16.
If I might, is there a reason for the inconsistency?
Inconsistency.
In the number of years that you're using, just...
We would like to use as many years, excuse me, Madam Chair, we would like to use as many fiscal years as possible, but because of the IRIS migration, we wanted to use a consistent number, so we used the maximum number of years we could under the new financial accounting system.
Thank you for that explanation. Senator Bishop.
I'll be real brief, maybe to help, just to give my opinion as somebody that's been in the department for a while. Yeah, a long time ago. We briefly touched on it, Madam Chair. The consequences, you know, and there's questions, what happens if we decertify and go back to federal OSHA? Well, I'll just put it, let's personalize it. We pass a lot of resolutions in this building, browbeating the federal government and wanting state control. Well, we have state control now, right? We have to operate at a minimum to the OSHA standards to run a state-run plan. Our standards can be higher than OSHA standards, but we have to operate at a minimum standard. So this is a housekeeping bill, not to downplay the bill or any questions from committee members. This is a housekeeping issue. But I'll give you an example of a federal agency that enforces mine safety and health in this state. So when you're dealing with a federal agency, you have to go through a metal detector. You might get an appointment, you might not get an appointment, and you walk down here to the Department of Labor and you can walk right into the commissioner's office. I'll give you one example of having a state-run plan with Alaskans. I went to a project on a multi-million-dollar construction project that had a technical problem, and I went on that site with my crew at ACOSH with mechanical inspection. After reviewing the process and going back and working with the contractor, working with the city, working together as Alaskans, we were able to come to a resolution that saved everybody a lot of time, money, and headaches and brought the project in on time. So that's the difference of working with the federal government or you want to work with our local state government, and I think that's the benefit of having a state-run plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Want to get to a sectional analysis. We've had the bill introduction by the sponsor. I do have a question for Ms. Kelly. Ms. Kelly, my understanding is this bill took effect, or I'm sorry, this requirement from the federal government took effect some time ago, and that we are not in compliance. So what has been the federal government's reaction? I believe you just said that by January 1st of 2017 that we were supposed to have this bill passed. So I recall the sponsor, Representative Keto, suggesting that there is threat or could be a consequence of inaction at withholding of federal support or fundings from other areas of our state or specifically to your department. Can you speak to the response from the federal government because we have not complied?
Madam Chair, the compliance, out-of-compliance date was January 1st of 2017, and the federal government has seen that we're working towards a solution. We, like many states, have to go through a legislative process, and that takes time. So as long as we are working towards that goal, they understand that, and they are working with us in the meantime. So as long as we're getting closer to that resolution, they have not had any issue with that. Besides being a finding on our annual evaluations, they realize that there are practical considerations.
Thank you. With that, does the federal government, through the bill that they passed, through the law that they enacted, require this to be in regulation, something that used to be in statute for setting a fine?
Madam Chair, no, they do not. We went with the regulatory avenue just because it seemed like the most practical way to make yearly adjustments possible, but neither the federal government nor the state government is tied to specifically having it in regulation.
Representative Quito, on behalf of small businesses, there has been at least some consternation around the issue of when you go below the radar as far as a statute that spells out specifics versus down into regulation where non-elected officials do calculations and go through a regulatory process that would take a statutory change to actually undo from the last report that I read. Can you say why the committee chose to go into the regulation versus a statute change that might fix the problem in a similar way? Representative Quito.
Madam Chair, certainly. So the situation that we have with the federal law is that they are actually requesting that agencies keep track of the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, and adjust the penalties to adjust to modifications of the CPI. We don't know if the federal government will be doing that on an annual basis or another periodic basis. The legislature can choose to deal with the penalties in statute, but if we set the penalties at the minimum level and the next year the federal government comes in and raises that by CPI, the legislature would have to come in and update statute to adjust that. It could end up being an annual change to statute, which to our committee felt as though it could be burdensome to the department, and we might not actually end up with a statutory change, risking that we would be in and out of compliance depending on year, depending on what the federal government has done with their minimum. What this statute does is say that the department in regulation cannot ever go above what the federal government's minimum penalty requirements are, so that the regulation will always track with that basic minimum requirement. Gives the department the ability through regulation that they can do without coming back to the legislature for approval to keep up with that basic minimum penalty requirement.
Representative Quito, then could it be said simply that the federal dollar penalty amount would be a cap for Alaska, and that the department couldn't go in and go beyond the minimum set by the federal government?
Madam Chair, yes, that is what we've designed the bill to do.
Thank you. Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, so, yeah, on the maximum in Section 6, line, page 3, line, well, lines 1 and 1 through 3, It covers the greater, but it doesn't cover the minimum. We're leaving the minimum in the purview of the commissioner, and I'm just wondering why we didn't match the two as well. So the commissioner can decide that she wants a higher minimum for each violation, but must be capped at the federal maximum. Can the sponsor sort of explain why we didn't decide that we should match the federal minimums as well?
Senator Machicki, I thought that was the question I just asked. So I thought that I said, are we in Alaska, based on the legislation before us, held to the minimum as our maximum for the state? So that's what I was trying to ask also.
Madam Chair, and if I have misstated, I think I defer to Ms. Kelly to clarify.
Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually think, through the Chair, Senator McChicky, you may be asking a different question, which is, are you referring to that single minimum penalty that is currently in statute? Because that is the only minimum penalty we have. Mostly the minimums are zero, except for the single willful violation minimum penalty.
If we could, what I'd like to do is go through a sectional. Representative Quito, Is your staff or is Ms. Kelly going to walk us through a sectional to understand the mechanics of the bill?
Madam Chair, I can have my staff, Ms. Ellis, come forward and go through the sectional analysis.
Thank you very much. Representative Keto, not to take any more of your time than we have to, we will be holding this bill. We would ask the committee consider amendments and have them to my office no later than Thursday at 5 p.m. on this bill. So, Representative Keto, if you have other things that you need to do, I totally understand.
Madam Chair, I've been informed that the House is gaveled in and is in session, so I should probably head downstairs. So I will leave this bill in the capable hands of my staff and the department.
Representative Keto, we'll thank you very much. Please exit for your floor session. We will try to open the public hearing. Depending on the amount of testimony, we'll close the public hearing and then set the bill aside, waiting for amendments, and we'll be working with your office. Thank you. And our bells are ringing now, too. Ms. Ellis, if you could identify yourself for the record and then take the committee through a walkthrough of the mechanics of the bill.
Gladly. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Caitlin Ellis, staff to Representative Keto. So the sectional analysis for House Bill 121 is probably in many of your packets as well. Section 1 establishes those minimum and maximums for the civil penalties. The commissioner may assess an employer for a willful or repeat violation of occupational safety and health provisions. They shall be set in regulation under the new section added by this bill. Section 2 would establish the maximum civil penalty the commissioner may assess for an employer for a serious violation and shall be set by regulation added by this bill. Section 3 establishes the maximum civil penalty for other than serious violations and shall be set by regulation. Section 4 establishes the maximum civil penalty for violations where an employer fails to correct a violation. So these are serious if they've already been notified and then fail to correct them. Again, able to be set by regulation. Section 5 establishes the maximum penalty for violations of posting requirements. Section 6 adds a new subsection that directs the commissioner to establish by regulation the maximum penalty to be imposed under A through D and G of this section and the minimum imposed under A. It stipulates that the maximum penalties, civil penalties, may not be greater than the corresponding federal penalties and must include adjustments to correlate with the inflation rates, just the CPI. Section 7 applies to violations occurring on or after the effective date. Section 8 allows transition language for the department to operate that.
Ms. Ellis, on the CPI discussion, would that affect a rate going up and down?
Through the chair, I believe so. As CPI goes up and down, it would be adjusted accordingly as well and on an annual basis.
Ms. Kelly, is that... just to confirm with the department, is that accurate? It would go up or down?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Senator Bishop.
And they can't exceed the, Madam Chair, thank you, and they can't exceed the federal maximum penalties either. Is that correct, Deborah?
Through the Chair, Senator Bishop, that is correct.
Thank you.
Is there any questions on the structure of the bill? Thank you for testifying before Senate Finance today. I'd like to open the public hearing on House Bill 121. Is there anyone wishing to testify on an act relating to occupational safety and health enforcement penalties and providing for an effective date? Is there anyone off net or online? Public hearing is closed. With that, I already stated my intent earlier as Representative Keto was exiting for his floor session. Senator Bishop, we will review the fiscal notes later, or would you like to review them now?
Later.
We'll review the fiscal notes the next time the bill is before us. Any committee comments? Amendments are due Thursday at 5 p.m. On this afternoon's agenda at 1:30, should we be off the floor? House Bill 215 Department of Health and Social Services, public health fees. With that, we're adjourned.